Hi, this is Rafael Alvarado. This is the show Poet Runner with my co-host Richard Modiano, and we're currently waiting for Douglas Kearney to come on. And since he's not on, Richard, is there any books that you've read lately that you might want to mention before Douglas comes on?
Well, we're going to be talking about his book Show, which is from Wave Books. And as soon as we get him on, but just to brief our listeners in advance, and I will check with Doug on this, but this
is there he is.
Book A.
Hey.
Hang on.
How doing?
Oh, great.
There he is.
Hey, good, good.
Hey, Doug. How are you?
Hey, how you doing, man? I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right, you know. How about you?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
I got Richard on the other line. You know Richard Modiano?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we were rambling a bit before you got on, and I was talking a little bit about the book in preparation, the book Show, in preparation for the full interview. And what I was about to tell our listeners is that this is a book for reading out loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to check with Doug and see if I've got that right, because it made sense. It, reading it out loud enriched the experience for me.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's you know, just trying to get to that space of, like, you know, it was Donald Hall who called it milk tongue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that place in which just the very pleasure of the sounds that you're making as you embody them, or just as you voice them, is a part of what, you know, you experience when reading poetry, potentially. And so I was really interested in thinking about particular modes of prosody, and thinking about, you know, just sound in a way that, you know, I think about sound all the time, but there were things that happened in the book that came before Buck Studies where I really felt like I had figured out a way to write a sentence that could capture as much of the kind of accentual, you know, syllabics that I wanted, that I really was feeling. And it just, like, those sentences, right? Those sentences, and not only thinking in terms of line, but also thinking about sentences, really made it possible for a lot more sort of sonic play.
Yeah, and of course, you know, ordinarily, you start out, and when you read a poetry book, you know, you read it silently, subvocally, you voice it to yourself. And when I was reading Show, I started out that way, and I said, I'm not getting the full experience of this, so I've got to hear it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I started reading it out loud, and as I said before, it deeply enriched my appreciation of the work of the poems. I mean, it's... There is, you know, sort of the classic taxonomy of a poem is its ideas, its images, and its music. And it seems to me that we miss a lot of, in a lot of poetry, we don't really have the music, or the music is not foregrounded. We have the images,
we have the
ideas, which is good, but the music is, to me, essential, because that is what the others float on. That is the sea which... the ships of the images, and the ideas are in the images, and the images are carried by the music in the best poetry. So you've got all three working here, but especially the music of that. And do you have the book with you, by the way?
I do.
Okay, good. Because I wonder if you, to illustrate what we've just been talking about, I wonder if you'd pick one to read out loud, or I could pick one if you like.
Oh, why don't you pick one? I'd love that. I love that.
Okay, well, one that I like in the first part is Dogged.
Okay. I enjoy that one. So Dogged, you know, is written for my friend the poet Ahmad Jamal Johnson, and it references a quote from W.B. Du Bois that he kind of, you know, put forth in an interview we did years and years and years ago for Boxcar. And it's this idea of, like, you know, within the kind of formulation of the double consciousness, it's only dogged strength, dogged strength. That speaking of dogs, that's my dog. There's only dogged strength that allows the subject, you know, this dual identity subject of the African American from tearing themselves apart. All right, so here's the poem. Was my strength here where I stood prior? I stayed together like a dog of what it's caught, thrashing. Up this maw is meat, thus tear away, then bone, thus what's left, body down. I'm low, so to hunt myself out, be God. True, true, I taught me some tether. True, true, I won't get away this time. I was at myself good there. I crouch over me, clatter some haunch, chatter some jaws, slaver, slaver. Want to get the meat to eat, better thrash my head. No, 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 and caught, I'm all, yes, yes, yes. My body there and torn away, open as maw was, then red. Once bones got in the maw, I go prostrate, devoted and theoretic. In a poached country, oh, no, 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 yes, 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 besetting itself to sick. What's itself, what's not, I'm those. Though such a country won't see me save my song, a knell I'm thus used to song. The maw maws into my body, oh, out the maw all, oh, what it is, what it isn't. Dogged, hunting, I'm in the way of such a country. Better thrash if I want to tear away, and don't I want? Better go, no, 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 oh, so whole and whole, so ma, what ma gives body, what that body sing. Oh, cuff, oh, cordon, oh, camera, how being placed take you. And I was saying about myself that this is, oh, such a country, hunting, countries all, more, more. It give, too. I was given the ma in the way of this country, the ma used to, like tool, or like accustomed. Was? I was, anyway, given them all, a new name to be called when I get called, to tell me when to do. Simple instructions, tricks. The dog stay, person go. The dog get the meat to be got. Yes, 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 used to it. Dog, dog, dog to that place for which some sigh. Not singing just now, though, oh, all up in this country, so no, no, no. I was never another thing. Or meat? My. I tear it away in the way of such a country. What it is, isn't my body, the maw open, singing now. Of the dumb singing just now. Even so, I'm song, used to. What's left? What's left? But the maw set upon my body placed all maw. Oh, the hunt. I'm used to it still, how my pulse double.
Oh, that's great. That's great hearing you read it. It's you know, wonderful. And, you know, listeners, this is, this is real poetry for me. I mean, there is, it's rich with ideas. it all fits together. I mean, it's like, this is the kind of poetry you can read again and again. You can get more from it. And hearing Doug just read it now, I mean, I have an even better appreciation for it. So,
I appreciate you so much.
Let me ask you something about how you composed that poem.
Mm-hmm.
What did you start with? Did you start with the idea, or was it an image that came to you?
This poem started as a kind of a complaint. It started because, I was trying to think my way around something that a student had said in a classroom. And it was the kind of thing where, like, in that draft, in that version of it, you know, it's the sort of thing where, you know, you want to be able to dismiss something, but you can't, right? So you're kind of sitting there sort of grappling with it. And, you know, from that, it became less about critiquing the student, right? Because the fact of the matter was I was upset because what they had said had landed in me in a way that meant that, like, oh, okay, so now I'm actually really thinking about this. And, you know, we walk around, I mean, I walk around as a teacher going like, well, you know, I want to be challenged by my students. And that was when that happened. And so, like, you know, I wrote the first draft and it was pretty, you know, it was pretty much just like, rah, right? But then when I returned to it, I began to kind of find another way of being with what the student had talked about. And I turned it more inward while still imagining somebody, like still imagining, like speaking to somebody. But what I like about how that poem ended up turning out was because it feels like somebody explaining themselves, it automatically kind of puts, you know, whoever's being addressed, right, into a position of, if not equality, power, right? If it's not, mm-hmm. it's not the same level, quote unquote, the power has shifted in a way that I think is really important. And so being in that space, you know, like allowed me to really ask these questions. And it was only after after maybe like the second or third draft that I really understood that what was happening in the act of the explanation, right, was just trying to keep something together, even if, like, the very fact of the explanation is sort of like, ah, these things, can they actually hold together? Or must they be torn apart? And so that, you know, brought me back to Ahmad's usage of that quote as a way of talking about my poetry, like, probably like 2006, 2007. So this question, right, like that the student hit upon was a question that I'm oftentimes thinking about. And so this allowed me the kind of place to do it in a way that I hadn't done it before. You know, you never want to necessarily say, oh, I'm never going to write a poem like this again. But it was something, this one, I learned something from thinking about what the student had said. I learned something from revisions of the draft. I learned something from thinking about what Ahmad had said. And so it's just this kind of feeling of like, it's not, I mean, it sounds like involution. It sounds like I'm just going in and in and in and in. But like, when you do that, what you do externally changes, right? You're in the world in a different way. And so I'm really grateful for all of the elements that came together in this poem.
Well, another poem that the poem that I'm talking about is Welter, and you have a little description about how that one came about. But and I picked this one for our listeners because I want them to understand that there is a variety of approaches to the poems in this. They're not all the same. There's a tremendous variation in them. And this poem Welter is a prose poem. For the, our listeners, of course, can't see the page of this, but you know they will buy the book, as I will insist later on. But this is a poem that is anybody could have this same experience. Let's put it that way. So. Let's hear Welter.
All right. Welter's epigraph is, in the U.S., news broke regarding the discovery of a mass grave of Rohingya Muslims at a human trafficking camp the same day as the first Mayweather-Pacquiao welterweight championship bout. Sick on it. Cameras, queasy green lush rush canopy, tilt down, thick bamboo covered twine bound. Tilt down, welter, dirt's got rags to gag up, hijab stuck in dun incisors. Zoom in and rack, what's that flesh there, bone there, bindled and cured skin? Presence, foul traffic, twittering pittas, bulbuls, upruffed, hum flies, plump as beans. Boom, the snowy-browed, rufous-chested sing-song, jungle jangle. Cut, their throats, rufous, that was months ago. And was that months ago? The camp, boom, boom, get the boom shotgun mic out the shot clean. Cut, there's too many damn birds, dirty. Cut, we can't use this. Rap, swelter, late, wait, later. Fight, woo, fight, tonight, woo, of the century, tonight, woo, wait, welters.
Yeah, that is like an Eisensteinian montage for me. The great Soviet filmmaker had this idea of associative montage where two completely different things are brought together to bring out to enrich the meaning and the experience for the viewer. And I felt that that's what I thought when I read this poem, was this bringing together of two different experiences with, I mean, we know that it's the TV medium that brings us our news, and we know that it's watching the fight on TV. And I was guessing that maybe you were watching the fight, and there was a news brief or a news flash, or the news came before or after, something like that. But in your poetic sensibility, you brought them together. You could see the connection between them. And it comes out in this poem, which I think is very powerful.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know what I love about your poetry is the constant evolution of your poetry. I mean, since I've known you, I've seen your poetry evolve to like to a whole higher level that some people just, you know, their poetry doesn't change. It's great poetry, but it doesn't evolve.
Oh, thank you, Raphael. I mean, like, I try not to get bored, you know, like with my own stuff. I try to, I don't know, I feel like if you write a poem and people go like, all right, okay, that's a poem, right? I feel like at some level you kind of can start wherever that one leaves off, right? Maybe overlap it just a little bit and then kind of push into something else. And you know, like, that's something that I sort of learned, like, from that, you know, that hip-hop group Outkast. I always felt like their albums would take you, like, okay, if most albums are going to take you to a 5, Outkast would take you to a 7. And then on their next album, they start then at 6, and then they can move to 8, and then they kind of just can keep pushing and pushing. And what I was saying earlier about, like, syntax and stuff, like for real, whenever I finish a project, like maybe a sequence of poems, or maybe anytime I feel like I'm really exploring a particular kind of syntactic construction or whatever, when I feel like, okay, I did that, not in a sort of a sense of like I mastered it, you know, you don't master stuff, but I mean like, okay, I've established an ability to do this, or I've learned things from that. Then I actually oftentimes, to write new poems, I have to like rethink the sentence. I have to be like, okay, well, how is syntax going to work in this poem so I'm not just doing the same thing I did before with a different skin? Right, and so like, that's something that I think about a lot.
Yeah, I have a painter friend, and I don't think this applies as much to poetry, but he was telling me that because he sells through a gallery, and the gallery likes his work and so on, but when he changes, when he innovates, they say, wait, hold on. I don't think we already have a market for your other paintings, but I don't know what we're going to do with this one. This is outside, and this goes beyond what you were doing before. Go back to that. You know, go back to what you were doing.
We know that one sells. Right.
And it takes a certain courage to step out of that and to move on in different directions.
I mean, I'm really grateful for that. I mean, the truth of it is, like, my first book, Fearsome, Red Hen published that in, like, 2006. And I was desperate to have another, like, manuscript done, like, before Fearsome kind of got out in the world. Because I wanted to write without sort of thinking about the very thing you were just talking about, which was, like, you know, like, they liked this, so I'm going to do that again. You know, and, you know, in the beginning, like the kind of people pleasing aspects of my personality I hadn't kicked them out of the car yet. You know, I hadn't kicked that out of the car. They weren't necessarily driving it, but they were like sitting there, and they had like the Google Map, right? They had the Thomas guide. They were sitting there going like, oh no, you got to turn right. And so like, you know, what was hilarious is that between, like once Fearsome came out, I wrote a manuscript called Drowning the Cities. And my wife, Nicole, looked at that manuscript when I finished it. And she was like, yeah, this is really kind of wanky, Doug. I don't think you should, this is a good look. I don't think you should do it. I was like, fine. And from that came the Black Automaton. So there was all of this kind of like shifting and really like very kind of, I don't want to say intentional, I want to say, but like very direct sort of sense of like, that's not, I'm not doing that, I'm not doing that, I'm not doing that. And now, you know, like, I just, like, I do laugh, you know, because one of the things that people, you know, bring up about show is, like, it doesn't have, like, the kind of what I call performative typography in the sense that, like, you're looking at the type and you go like, oh, wait, this is telling me to read in a certain kind of way,
which any poem does,
right? Every poem does that. But when you have a poem that's like, there's something at a diagonal and there's something this way, people kind of go like, oh, wait, what am I supposed to do? So like,
yeah.
People talked about show. And what's hilarious is the manuscript that I'm finishing now is like almost all these kind of collage poems, right? So I kind of laugh every now and then because like the next book, like visually will not look like show, you know, unless, you know, something else happens and I kind of go like, oh, maybe I want to do that book. But I'm actually really excited about kind of reversing the sort of the trajectory because like in all the books leading up to show, I felt like the visual poems, performative typography poems were starting to take up more and more real estate. They were starting to have more and more space, which I loved a lot. And then show comes out and it's just sort of like none of that. And now I'm thinking that the next one, which I've been calling, I imagine I've been science fiction always, might just be all, like it might all be these sort of visual poems, kind of like reversing that. But then at the same time, I'm working on another, I'm working on another manuscript that will follow that one, which kind of gets back in that sort of question of that sort of dynamic of back and forth and give and take. But that one's being influenced by the density of the collage pieces that I'm doing right now. And I sort of said to myself, what would happen if I use these same approaches but limited myself to like only 4 visual sources as opposed to like dozens in each one? So like it is this kind of constant, you know, as you were saying, about it is this constant like evolution or change and just trying to just kind of keep moving. And that to me is like one of the exciting things about, you know, getting to do this, you know?
Well, you know, of course you have to make your own writing interesting to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise,
absolutely.
It becomes a chore.
Yeah. Right? Right? I mean, and you can't, like, I don't feel like you can expect anybody else to be changed or interested if you're not, right? I feel like.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, so you have to be willing to risk stuff, you know, to not do the things, to not just do the things that you're already good at, but try to push them in ways that stretch and stretch you.
Exactly. So I'd like to hear the title poem, which is in the second section.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I always say when I read this poem is I teach a class sometimes that's a class in creating new poetic forms. So all the students each create 2 poetic forms, and everybody in the class writes a poem in one of their forms. Like, so everybody does that. And a student I had at CalArts named Indigo Weller created this form called a torsion, which is named after like lace weaving patterns. And it reworks the sestina as a form in a very interesting way.
Right.
And so,
yeah.
And torsion as a lace weaving pattern, because I believe it was Indigo's grandfather worked in a lace weaving factory. And, you know, like, so structure, so formally it's supposed to have these certain kind of repetitions, but then structurally, like ideationally, the concepts of these poems, if you're writing a torsion, is a kind of a revisiting a negative experience or a memory or a feeling and just not getting out of it, just revisiting. So this is show. Some need some body or more to ape sweat on some sight. Bloody pearl or dirty spit, hocked up for to show who gets eaten. Rig body up, bow bow to breeze a lay's jig and sway to Greg's good fiddling. Pine beat dusk, a spot where stood body, thus they clap when I mount bunk, jig up the lectern bow to say it's all good. We gathered, withstood the bends of dives deep, burr, darker, they clap as I get down. Sweat highlights my body, how meat's dyed bloody, looks fresher for show wing. I got deep spit out my mouth, a rigid red rhyme, bloody melon, huh, no sweat, joking, nobody knows the trouble, rig full of days, so why fix this mess, spit in tragedy's good eye. This one's called Jig. Gogglers then bow housefully. They clap, be misunderstood. Hang notes high or deep, make my tongue a bow. What's the gift, my good song box? The gift, chick, gold nickels from deep down my craw. They clap, I so jolly stood on that bank. Body picked over blood, E, rotto, Braxton sweat, E, brow syndrome. Spit out a sax bell, ring on the grossest show of feels. The cell sweat equals work, bloody ink pot of body. I stay nib dip show, never run dry. Rigorously I spit, outstressed feet, lines jig, ha 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 ha, good one that I is. Bow deep but not out, stood shining dim. They clap, waves slapping home. Deep don't mean sunken, good not yummy, right? Bow blanched with foam, jig jigs. This one's called They Clap. Barrow, so much deep ends upon dead. Stood I on that body, bloody rise a sweet body. There you is to sweat it. Let's be tough, right? Some ass post spit to lip. I said shell.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, that's like that. This is this poem is like a tour de force in the best sense of that term. Mm. I mean, it's got so much in it. And this, and it was one of your students that came up with this for him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow.
Indigo Weller.
Wow.
Yeah. And the title poem of the next collection is also based on a form that one of my students made.
What an ingenious assignment, too, to come up with a form.
It's wild, right?
You will learn about poetry if you were assigned to come up with your own form. You will really learn about poetry. I mean, you will struggle with, even if you don't come up with anything good, but just the attempt to do it will really get you into what is involved in poetry and writing a poem, I think.
Absolutely.
So that's a terrific assignment.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
So how much time do we have left on Raphael?
About 3 minutes. Actually, I was going to mention something.
Go ahead.
So you get a lot from students. I appreciate that because I've been arguing with poets about poets need to have a job and not just be poets for money. And I think to me, when you talk about interacting with your students, that proves the point because you get inspiration from your work.
Yeah, there are times where I like to think like, oh, what if I could just, you know, write and not have to do anything else? But I do think that so much of what pushes me, you know, is my students' work. I was listening to this interview with George Clinton, right? And his whole thing was, he was talking about how, like, the interviewer asked him, you know, how do you stay, like, relevant? Why is it that, you know, people still, like, care about your music? And he's like, because I always pay attention to what's coming next, right? He's like, I don't just immediately see it and it's not what I do or whatever and then immediately, like, hate on it or immediately, like, you know, be like, nah, this, what is this? And he watched tons of musicians of his era, right, look at new music coming out, and they were just sort of like, man, that's not music, that's noise. And he watched them kind of fade away, right? And so, like, that's been a principle that I've been trying to, you know, trying to live, you know, live by, you know. And I believe that if you're teaching, your job at some very profound level is to teach your own obsolescence, right? Like, you're supposed to, like, your students are supposed to, like, outstrip you, right? Now, I want my students, I give my students a run for their money, right? I'm not just going to lay down, but that energy behind it is something like, I mean, I always just describe it like this. I'm almost 50. It took me however many years it took me to write each of these poems, right? But if I can, like, talk to a student in their 20s, for example, and be like, this is what I did, this is what I learned, this is how I got to here, then in my head, they get, like, this head start. And it's not like they're only talking about my poetry, but it's like they get this head start. They're like, okay, he tried this stuff and this is what he got. What if I tweaked that? And what took me 20 years to figure out, now they can kind of like encounter in one book and be like, oh, okay, so this is the new starting point. So when I talk about that kind of like creating a new starting point, it's also for readers and writers. Like, they're starting, you know, wherever I am or wherever whoever they're reading, you know, is. Like, that's not just me, right? So I think that really taps into what you're talking about right there, Raphael.
Yeah. So we've been talking to Doug Kearney. The book is Show, S-H-O, by Douglas Kearney, available from Wave Books. You can get it at your local independent bookseller or directly from the publisher. And as a last resort, you could get it from Amazon. But go to those first two places, independent bookseller and the publisher, because, you know, poetry publishers, small press publishers, they need your support. And the best way to support them is to go right to them, and you can order directly from them online.
Yep.
So, Doug, thanks for
having
this. And I really
enjoyed this
conversation.
Doug, do you have anything coming up before you leave?
Oh, wow. Shoot. I mean, I'm going to be – I actually don't have wait. I'm doing an event at the Walker Arts Museum in Twin Cities in about a month. That's sort of like imagining possibilities around, around ecology, ecosystems. I'm doing a masterclass with Obsidian on Black listening strategies. Just stuff kind of coming out, you know, kind of happening.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the show, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you so much. Thank y'all so much.
All right, Doug. Thanks a lot.
And now we have the runner for the show, and I don't want to mispronounce your name. Howdy.
Rahul.
How do you pronounce that?
It's Rahul.
Rahul?
Basically, the way it gets confused most of the time with the Spanish name Raul, but it's basically...
Yes, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I did not want to do that. No, I've been... I got in contact with Benny. He told me about you. I've noticed on your Facebook, a lot of your stuff is really positive. The way you talk about focus, about doing things, it's all positive. There's no negative in your Facebook that I've been noticing, paying attention to. And the way you go about, training and stuff.
Right. So I just believe, it's like universe is energy, right? So you put negative stuff out there, you'll get negative stuff back. So the more positive you are, I think you're going to just keep attracting more and more positivity. So that's been my approach to life and over the past 4 years.
Yeah, I noticed. I do agree with that, because when I'm I always tell people the way that I train is all my anger goes to the lifting, and the running is about calm and just going. And there's no anger, and there's just the run.
Right. And I think you're right, and somebody rightly pointed that out when they said that running is basically meditation on feet, right? So you're so engrossed in that activity that you're just by yourself, you know? So it feels great.
I do love the alone time. I don't know. I mean, I can go. Lately, I've been trying to do at least 15 miles a day, and I notice when I'm like that long stretch of time when you just get lost in your own thoughts, and the focus is pretty straight.
Right, and I think 15 miles per day, like as you know, and like if there are runners out there, they know that it takes a lot of effort, to hit that 15-mile mark every day. So I think that's a great feat, from your part as well.
I'm a little stubborn. It's just being stubborn. What races do you have coming up? Because I noticed that you do a lot of races.
right. So I've been trying to mix up things, you know. So I do marathons, ultra marathons, as well as obstacle course races, like if anybody knows about the Spartan races. So they are basically around, like, running on the mountains and doing obstacles, which are basically body weight obstacles, like monkey bars, cliffhangers, carrying sandbag and stuff. I feel those actually really test your endurance as well as your strength limits as well. So I just did a Spartan Super this weekend in Palmerton. It was a 10K race, but it had almost like 3,000 feet of elevation with 30 obstacles. So I think that was like more difficult than actually running a marathon, to be frank. So I like doing those sort of races. And as I said, like the upcoming races, I have a city challenge race coming up. It's basically designed to be an urban obstacle race. It is similar to Spartan, but the only difference is that it has no elevation. It happens in the city. So it happens in downtown Jersey City, in Hoboken, in New York City. And it is like a 5K race, and it has 30 obstacles which you need to kind of complete. And what is the best time you can get in those? And then I have a 5-miler the next day from New York Roadrunners. It's called the Masters 5K. It's basically about a team event. It's like big teams in New York get registered, and like how many members can you get in a team, and what is the time that you can hit. So like basically looks at the average time of the team. I have those races coming up. And then in terms of long races, we have a wine glass marathon coming up in October, which I'm doing with a couple of friends, and then maybe the Philly marathon.
Wow. I just got maybe six marathons left. I mean, six different events, not all marathons coming up for the rest of the year. You seem... That's a lot. But yeah, no,
yeah. It is, and I think like the bigger group that you have, you know, in terms of running, you meet so many different individuals. So like if someone's doing, you know, some race, you really get it, you know, kind of excited, and you just want to do it with them. So with me, it happens most of the time, right? It turns out to be like a good event. So in fact, it happened to me, like the Spartan Super, which I did this weekend. One of my colleagues was doing it, so he's like, do you want to do it? So I'm like, okay, it sounds exciting, you know, let's do it. So most of them, you know, happen impromptu sometimes.
Yeah, I noticed, how do you train? I mean, how do you train for all these events? Because they're all different events. Do you have a certain way you train for each event, or do you train the same for all the events?
So I actually have a very specific training plan. So I have a personal trainer with I train three times a week, and that doesn't involve anything related to running. It is basically only related to body-weighted workouts. So what I mean by that is that those are basically just high-intensity workouts to get your heart rate up. So it involves doing burpees, push-ups, pull-ups, bear crawls, ab crunches, and any activities which basically tends to bring your heart rate up so that in any endurance event, you do not feel fatigue or you do not collapse. And it also trains on no rest. So when you're training, right, so around like 45 minutes training, so there is no break in that 45 minutes about the workouts that you do. So to just give you an example, right? So if you're doing burpees, so you would do 100 burpees in one go. And when you're done with 100 burpees, your rest would be doing air squats. Since you are like so exhausted doing burpees, now squats is your rest. But you just keep on going, continuously bringing your heart rate up and try to train your body with not drinking any liquids in between. So that really actually helps you to break all mental and physical barriers. So that is the training which I do twice a week with my trainer. And my trainer is actually a pro Spartan guy. So he exactly knows, you know, what we are doing. So that's why actually I'm pretty much confident training with him. And then I actually run almost every day, like averaging around 10 miles a day. And that can vary from hill runs to leisure runs on the waterfront, speed runs. But I'm trying to kind of, you know, average around 10 miles. And the 4 days which I have left in which I don't train with my trainer, I basically do some light weights and pull-ups and push-ups. So I do very few exercises, but more repetitions.
I do notice from your pictures that you have tone. A lot of runners don't use weights. They don't train that way. They just run, and there's no muscle on them.
Right. So actually, that was my always fear. You know, like I was like, once I was running, I don't want to be actually the skinny runner, right? Like, it was like, oh, that's like you got a runner's body. Because I think like overall, it's like, you know, that's the way society views a runner, right? Is that they have a specific image of a runner in their mind already, right? So like the way you look, the pro distance runner. So they just feel like, you know, runners have to be in a certain way. In fact, like when I saw you as well, right? You also have a pretty well-defined body, right? So that actually kind of puts people off track, because in their mind, right, when they speak to you, they visualize a different body structure. But when they meet you, right, they're like, oh, wow. That's it. So I always wanted to be in that phase where I didn't want to be typecasted into a runner's body. I always wanted a body which can run as well as lift in need of, you know, any activity. And that's also one of the reasons why I mix running and Spartan races. Because it is a catch-22 situation, right? Like, how much can you run? How much can you lift? But at least you can maintain a specific balance, you know, to get better at both worlds.
Well, the funny thing to me was I always, when it came to running, everybody says you're not going to be able to maintain your muscle tone. You're not going to lose it. You're going to lose it. And I kept training with weights and kept running, so it balanced out. But if I would have listened to the whole thing about, you're not going to keep your body, your muscles, they're going to be eaten by your running.
You know, but the thing about general view is that most of the people who give you any opinion, right, they have not done that thing themselves, right? So they have their own understanding about things. So it's not like they have been there, done that, right? They just have their own opinions based on things they have heard or listened. So when I started running, right, exactly like you, people are like, oh, you're going to get injured, right? So I'm like, how much do you run? They're like, oh, we hardly run. So I'm like, how can you comment, right? Like, someone's going to get injured if you actually have not done that. So I always take it with a pinch of salt, right? I always feel like who is giving you the advice? Because I've seen, like, anybody who's done something, you know, who's been a pro runner or pro lifter would never tell you to stop, because they know that, you know, how adaptable the body is. So.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. How many ultra marathons have you ran? And what's the most miles? I think you told me 47.
So 47 was the most miles when we spoke, right? And after that, actually, I ran the New York 100K. So it's called TGNY, which is the Great New York 100K. So I just ran that 4 weeks back. And I think that's around like 62.5 miles. And I think that's the most I ran. So like 47 was before, but I think I breached that, you know. And I was pretty happy, because like 100K was something of a taboo to me, because I always thought that, oh, 100K is going to be, you know, some of an event which is actually going to put me in that ultra bucket where people feel that, okay, like he has actually ran a real ultra. Because before that, I ran like a 50K and stuff, which is also called an ultra. But, you know, it is not actually an ultra till the time you do 100K.
Yeah. I agree with you.
To be really frank, right? Like, I felt really good, you know, after the 100K. So I did it in 12 hours, like, averaging around, like, 10 miles. And I came in sixth, actually, in that race. So I was pretty happy because, like, I've been running all the while, and I'm not the fastest runner, but if there is an event of endurance, I feel I can actually just keep going. So I was happy because, like, I think after mile 51, that was the time when I was actually 27, and I had energy left, and I just, like, hit the last 10 miles, you know, at a 30-minute pace, and I then came in, like, sixth overall, so I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, it sounds great. I called, I'm doing the Bulldog Run in August, and that's a 50K, and I called it a baby ultra, and everybody's, no, it's an ultra. I know, but it's not 50 miles, and it's not 100, it's 31. I know it's 5 more miles, and it's probably going to hurt, but to me, it still doesn't feel like it's an ultra yet.
Yeah, but I think that's like a start to an ultra, and I'm sure, like, once you do that 50K, right, like, it is like an addiction, right? You just want to kind of keep going, you know? And
yeah.
What I've seen from your post as well, and I'm sure that you're not going to stop at that. Once you do that, I feel, you know, like, the most important thing is that when you're hitting that 50-miler race first time, right, that 44 to 45 mile is the, like, a mental breakdown element, right? Where you feel like, oh, you cannot just, you know, go, like, you just have to stop. And sometimes, you know, like, a lot of people resort to walking as well, that's fine. But mentally, once you cross that 50-mile barrier, right, you, in your mind, know that, okay, you can actually, you know, do it, whatever. Because on that day, you will be crushed. But a couple of days later, you will feel like, oh, nothing happened, right? Like, I didn't die. It's like,
yep.
Because we feel that what's going to happen after 50 miles, am I going to be, like, you know, hospitalized or something? And then after that, the marathon is just going to be feel like a half marathon.
Yeah, it's funny because a lot of people notice how I train at the gym. They notice that I leave the gym and I come back 2 to 3 hours later to still work there. And then when I go up to do 15 minutes on the stair climb for extra, like, why do you do that? Mm-hmm. Just, I go, it's to build the endurance. If the body can keep taking it, that means I'll be ready. But if I don't try to be ready and I don't push myself a little more every once in a while, I'm not going to be ready for these runs.
Yeah, you know, like, since you said that 15 minutes, like, there is, like, an interesting thing, right? I was, like, reading an article about Djokovic. So, you know, like, when Novak was actually starting up, you know, and when Federer and Nadal were the champions, right? If you notice, like, he was almost, like, 50th and 60th in world ranking. So they said that for him to be number one, he didn't have to do much changes because he was already good, right? So that 1% change that he did in his training and strategy made all the difference. So actually where people feel, oh, 15 minutes is not going to do anything. But that is the thing which is going to make all the difference, you know, in the long term. That little extra, you know, are you actually able to go that? So I'm with you, man. Like, if you get time and if you have the energy to put that little extra, do it other than, you know, just sitting on the couch, you know, and doing nothing.
I notice when I do the extra 15 minutes on level 20 on the Stairmaster, I'm sweating like crazy, but I feel good, you know, because I did
it
that
is.
Little extra amount.
It is.
You know?
It is. And to your point, right, I also tell people, right, like, especially in downtown, right, most of the people are living in apartments, right, not in houses, and those are like high rises. So I always tell them, like, use the stairs, right, like, those 15,
yep.
20 floor stairs, right? That's going to make all the difference. Like, initially you feel that, okay, you cannot breathe, your heart rate's up, you know? But, like, skip the elevator, man. Just keep doing that something extra. So, but again, like, to be really frank, right? You can only advise people if they want to take your advice. So, you know, now these people get offended very soon, right? Like, you give anybody an advice and they're like, why the hell are you telling me this? So I'm a bit actually reluctant myself, you know, to give advice to anybody. But I would prefer to take the stairs, you know, any given time.
No, stairs, I mean, it's a little extra, but it helps. I mean, I've actually, when I run, if I find stairs, I remember where those stairs are and I go back to them. I found out the Hollywood Bowl near where I live, there's stairs. So every once in a while, I go run those stairs. And I think I like stairs. I found out stairs are easier than hills. I thought stairs would be harder,
oh, yeah.
But stairs are easier. I don't know why.
But actually, like, when you start running on the stairs, right, actually, you feel that burn and you feel like, oh, man, your legs have become like jelly, right,
yep.
At some point of time. You cannot. So that's a good feeling sometimes, and that builds in endurance as well. And actually, that does help, you know, when you're actually running on the hills as well.
Well, I have these one stairs that there's no stopping. So going, there's no like break. There's not like little like, you know, 2 feet walk. So I try to keep going all the way up. But like you said, your legs become jelly towards the end. And it's like,
right,
and you're just happy when you get done.
And in fact, you know, like this race, I noticed something different. I was doing the Spartan Super in Palmerton. And normally we have more difficulties, you know, like when we go up, right? Like when you're going up the hill, running up the hill. So in this event, like we had like a 60-pound sandbag, which we had to carry. And there is a slope, right? It's almost like 50%, you know, like downhill. And that actually killed my quads, you know, like it completely destroyed my quads. I had no idea till that time that getting down with heavy weight is going to put so much pressure on your legs that actually climbing up felt much better. So, yeah. It's like different muscles get trained differently, and sometimes what you feel, you know, it's easy, it's difficult. Same thing like in Boston Marathon, sometimes downhill actually kills people, you know, before they could actually get a good time. So,
what do you do for your nutrition? What do you do for your nutrition? I take, I have a pre-workout drink before I run that works pretty good, and then there's the recovery stuff I took and the protein drinks just to keep my weight up.
Yeah, you know, like when I actually started, right, I used to take like a lot of pre-workout protein and stuff, right? But at this point of time, right, I do have like, to be frank, you know, I have the pre-workout, I have the protein shake, everything, but I'm just now taking it on a need-only basis. So what I do, I kind of like, since COVID, right, like we are working from home. So I work in an investment bank, so I have a desk job. So when I'm at home, I have an option to cook food for myself, which I did not have, you know, when I was actually working out. So I was more relying on protein shakes, you know, and some food substitute which had more proteins in them. But since I'm home, I tend to cook more for myself, you know. So like today, actually, before this call, right, I actually just marinated some salmon and I kept. So once I'm done, I'm just going to kind of grill the salmon and have it some rice, salmon rice. So morning, I eat eggs. So my food is very basic, nothing fancy, but I try to avoid junk food and sweets, you know, like mostly. So that are not a major part of my diet. And one thing I've realized is that during summer training, fruits are like heaven, you know, like watermelon, pineapple, strawberries.
Oh, yeah.
They give you so much nourishment and they kind of retain so much water in the body.
No, I love, I forget who recommended it, but I tend to eat oranges after I run.
Oh, that's
Someone
beautiful.
Someone said it was
like,
good for you.
So, you know, like when I was running the 100K last month, right, the weather was around like 85, 90 degrees. It was hot. And what happens, right, you must have noticed when it's like really hot, your appetite is completely suppressed, right? You don't feel like eating any solid foods. So you want liquids and water. But again, like if you're just drinking water, you cannot survive longer. And again, the gels, right, which people take during their long runs, like my thing is like how many gels can you actually eat, right? For me, actually, I cannot actually eat anything which is so sweet. So one or two gels and I'm done. So what happens in this 100K, you know, like at the aid station, they had watermelon and oranges. And to tell you the fact, right, like that actually helped me complete that 100K. The watermelon was beautiful. Like it has so much water in it. It keeps so much water retained in your body for long distances. And orange is actually, with the vitamin C, it always keeps you going. So I think fantastic. Like I have a newfound love towards fruits from the time I started running long. So I'm to be frank, I'm not a big advocate of vegetables because I don't eat much. But I do love fruits a lot. And I try to eat like good proteins, right, in terms of egg, fish, steak occasionally, and lamb chops. I like lamb chops because like they have got a lot of fat in them, so I try to like eat more fats before like a really long ultra run. So when I get up next day, have a lot of actually fat already stored in my body. So that's been my mantra, and I think it's worked pretty well for me.
Well, your diet's a lot better than mine because I have to eat at work a lot, and I usually eat whatever they make, be it hamburgers, french fries, or something like that.
But. Yeah, you know, like when I was working, like, and I agree with you, like that, sometimes it becomes unnecessary, but again, that becomes so much detrimental, you know, and because I just feel like, you know, like the body, like, it's very difficult for the body to get rid of junk foods and fat, you know, like if it's not being used then. And somehow I have actually now developed a complete resistance towards, you know, like, junk food and fast food and fries and burgers and pizza. So there are some days, you know, like after the race where they have pizza, I tend to kind of, you know, stay hungry but not eat. Like, and I would just like go home or someplace where I have to eat and then eat there. But again, it's basically like different needs and necessities, right? If you have to, you have to. But if I have an option, I would avoid it.
Oh, yeah, of course. If I have the option, I'd rather eat healthier. But lately, I don't have that option. So then I have the protein drink to make up for the bad stuff. And I tend to eat a lot of protein bars to make up for the crap that I put in my system. But somehow I managed to maintain and be able to run. And I'm happy that it hasn't affected the running to a bad point.
So are you a non-vegetarian? Like, do you consume meat
yep.
in your diet?
Yep. That's only when they give it to me at work because I can't afford it. I mean, a cheeseburger here and there, but usually I don't eat meat a lot because it's, you know.
So, you know, like, what I was doing research, you know, like, and I was trying to, like, figure out that what actually I can, you know, do to have the best meal in the cheapest possible way, right? So I was actually trying to do a lot of cost-benefit analysis, like, how can I actually have meals which are not fancy, but which provide me all the nutrition required? And I can tell you, you know, you can agree or disagree, but I figured out, like, there are four most important components of your diet, you know, which you can get from the market, which are not expensive and which will give you the required nourishment. So one is eggs, right, which is a must. So because eggs you can actually buy in wholesale, even if you eat 3 to 4 eggs, 5 eggs, you know, a day, that's like great amount of proteins, you know, and if you're a runner, you can actually not be worried about eating egg whites or no egg whites. Then the second best thing is milk. You can actually consume good amount of milk, you know, and get a container, you know, from the supermarket, which is like much cheaper than, you know, getting a burger. Third is bananas, right? Like for runners, I think that is a really great blessing for us. Like it's cheap, it's nice, it's got maximum benefits. And the fourth thing which I've noticed is that you can always get good peanuts, you know. Peanuts have so much good quality, you know, to improve bone density, to keep you stuffed, and, you know, not keep you hungry. And if you see, all these four food components, right, are not very expensive. So when I actually go to the supermarket and I buy these four food components, my bill is like always a minimalistic. So normally, like, when you ask people about the diet, people would suggest, like, really fancy diets, right? Like have a steak, have salmon, have this. But if you see, right, the difference in benefit is not much. So we eat some food, right, because maybe because we can afford it or maybe because we develop a taste, which is, and develop taste is not something, you know. But if we really have to, if I have to survive, you know, on basic, I have really listed down, you know, like what are the basic foods that I need to survive and which can actually take me the distance. So I realized that if I have some point of time or really tight budget, I can always rely on these four basic food components, which can give me all the required benefits that I require. And I don't need anything else. Even like, I don't need like any protein shake, protein bars and stuff. But I realized like I used to have like a lot of protein bars at work, but I then realized like the sugar content is getting too high, you know. It's really kind of, you know, adding to the waistline. So I do eat that, but like now only as a necessity. And If I eat a protein bar, I would like eat a half a protein bar and then keep a half for the next day.
Oh man, it's been great talking to you. We've actually done a whole half hour, and actually, I would love to have you on the show again, like maybe in six months to see where you are.
No, definitely.
I've asked almost every runner that I found interesting. Basically, most of them have been that I want them to come back, like in 6 months, just to see where they are in their training and their races and what they've accomplished since we last talked. I figured that would keep the show interesting, you know, bring people back, you know, maybe 6 months to a year and to see which, you know, how many miles they've run. You know, because I think you're going to keep doing it. You know, I've had Benny on twice already.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good. Benny's a good guy. I'm actually waiting for him, you know, to be back in Jersey and start running with us again.
No, Benny's great. I mean, we did two races together. We did the Griffith Park Half Marathon and the Orange County Marathon. And we've ran together like twice in L.A., you know, and it's something that I'm not used to running with somebody. But it was actually kind of good to actually run with somebody. You know,
I saw the picture once. Yeah, I know it's been great, you know, talking to you as well. I didn't even realize that we like actually up 30 minutes already. So it's been fantastic. I'll be more than happy to come back again, you know, in 6 months' time.
No, actually,
definitely
there's plenty more things that we could talk about. No, and I love the way you talk about the running and the training, and it's like people who don't run don't understand the level of commitment that's in our head to the running and to the focus that we have that we need to keep doing this.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think it takes a lot of sacrifice as well, right? And I think every runner knows about it. People feel, oh, running's fun, you can keep doing it. But yeah, it definitely takes, you know, like you have to sacrifice somewhere. You cannot be like really sleeping late and getting up early and running and, you know, been drinking, running. And like there are some things you have to give up, you know, to get some things.
I like when I talk to girlfriends, we can't have sex all the time. It's like, what do you mean? I kind of like, I'm a runner and I can't have weak legs. He goes, and what do you mean? I'm like, I don't want to have to explain that to you. But this is the thing that keeps me balanced. If I don't run, I'm going to be out of balance. So you wouldn't want me out of balance. So, you know, if you're going to go out with me, you have to understand that, you know, this is the way my head works.
No, at this point of time, if I don't run any given day, like I'm like the nastiest and the most frustrated person around. Let me tell you that. So, whatever happens, I just go out there, you know, like get a run in, and then I'm actually a sane person. So at this point of time, I think running, not just running, it's like becomes such an integral part of me, you know, that I cannot imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically like getting up in the morning, brushing your teeth. Right? For me, it's like getting up,
yep,
having that
it's
coffee, and
thing.
Just going out. That's it. Yeah. So. And I think,
well,
I always feel good when people are on the same page. They understand, you know, like what exactly we mean. So.
No, it's like I wake up, my day is go to the gym for an hour and do the weights and then run, then come back to the gym. And then if I have a little more time, do the start climb. If I don't, great, I got my 10 to 15 miles and I'm good. But if I don't do that every day, or if I can skip one day, but it's, if I don't do that regularly, I don't feel right. I feel like I'm missing part of what I need.
No, definitely. I agree with that. So, no.
Well, it's been
thanks,
great having you on. I'll send you the show once it's done. Now I'm probably gonna mention the things that I use to see if maybe get some sponsorship eventually. You know, the
thanks. No.
Like I take Jolt,
no,
which is from 6 a.m. run. The pre-workout, it's pretty good. It keeps me going. It wakes me up. And I love having you on the show. And I'd love to hear when you do your next one. Have you done a 100-mile run yet?
No, I'm doing the TJMI 100-mile actually next year in July.
Then we should talk in July when you've done it. It'd be great to hear how it went. Talk to you maybe a couple months before you do it and talk to you afterwards. You know, talk to you during the process of training and then talk about after how it felt to finish it.
Definitely. Should be good. Yeah.
Oh. It was great having you on the show.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks for that. Thanks for them. Take care. Have a good one.